Good evening. This is Peter Hammond in the studio for From the Front Line. Remembering and learning from the Holocaust in Rwanda, 24 years later. 24 years ago, 6th of April, 1994, one of the most dreadful campaigns of mass murder was unleashed upon the Tutsi people of Rwanda. In just 100 days, more people were slaughtered with machetes and clubs than have died from atomic weapons in all of history. At the time, world media was focused on South Africa's first one-man, one-vote elections. When the genocide was launched on the 6th of April, 1994, most African correspondents were in South Africa covering the elections. The MRND government of Rwanda meticulously organized the genocide. The French-trained presidential guard, the army, the gendarmes, and the civil administrators were mobilized to slaughter the Tutsi minority tribe. Central to the MRND strategy was to sow confusion so that no one would know what was happening. They isolated their victims by imposing a news blackout, by cutting the telephone links, establishing a dense network of roadblocks, and imposing a nationwide curfew. Now, these measures kept people in their homes and prevented most people from fleeing. By cutting communications and restricting travel, they isolated their victims and sought to stifle the flow of news. Following the assassination of the president by surface-to-air missile, the MRND government, the Mouvement Révolutionnaire National pour le Développement, launched a campaign of disinformation. It portrayed the killings as a spontaneous outbreak of tribal violence. It sought to confuse the mass killing of defenseless people with the war, and it played the humanitarian card by pleading for international aid. All of this was just a smokescreen to conceal the state-sponsored genocide. Amidst this calculated confusion, many foreign aid workers assisted in the disinformation campaign by contributing ill-informed comments such as, "Everyone is killing everyone. It is uncontrollable violence. The Hutus and Tutsis are killing one another again." Having killed opposition politicians, Rwandese journalists, human rights activists, and others who might present an accurate report on a cold-blooded campaign of mass murder, the MRND campaign continued their strategy of disinformation by portraying the violence as spontaneous rage in response to the assassination of the president. Now, initially, international attention focused generally on the plight of foreigners. Camera crews were understandably only prepared to travel with international troops, and those international troops' mission was to evacuate the foreigners. So this naturally led to a slanted and very incomplete picture being portrayed to the world. The murder of 10 Belgian soldiers on the 7th of April only heightened this preoccupation with the evacuation of foreigners. It is very probable that the killers were instructed to murder these Belgian soldiers precisely in order to make the evacuation of foreigners the international priority. It also further encouraged the withdrawal of UNIMAR, the United Nations Assistance Mission, to Rwanda, which happened in stages. This strategy of disinformation and terror was spectacularly successful. To this day, most people worldwide do not understand what happened in Rwanda or why it's happened, even more importantly. That is why my mission to Rwanda, I was compelled to produce a compact book that would not only expose what had happened in the horrific massacres in homes, hospitals, churches, and on the streets, but the reasons why the systematic slaughter was unleashed upon the Tutsi Protestants of Rwanda. My book, Holocaust in Rwanda, reveals the events leading up to the intense, widespread violence, and more importantly, the lessons we need to learn from the genocide in Rwanda. President Paul Kagame, at the formal 10 years commemoration of the Rwandan genocide, condemned the international community's failure, a convenient failure to take responsibility. And that's what it is. It's a failure on so many levels, but also a failure to take responsibility and acknowledged what happened and why it happened, how it happened, and how we allowed it to happen, and how it could have been prevented. The cemetery at Nyanza was another place visited. The cemetery contains the graves of 3,500 people who were massacred after being abandoned in a schoolyard by UN peacekeepers. The Holocaust in Rwanda book is unique in that it examines the disgraceful involvement of liberal church leaders, gun control, and media manipulation. Rwanda was a gun-free zone. The mass murderers successfully manipulated and abused the media to vilify the targeted Tutsis, to dehumanize them, to call them Inyenzis, cockroaches, and to mobilize masses of Hutu majority to kill their Tutsi neighbors. The scandalous role of the French government in providing assistance, training, and weapons to the mass murderers, and even the French military expedition to create a safe zone for the fleeing Hutu mass murderers, providing sanctuary even for many of the architects of the genocide, is also revealed in this book. To this day, some of the architects of the genocide, key players in the genocide of 1994 in Rwanda, are living under the protection of the French government and of the Canadian government. In addition, Holocaust in Rwanda looks at the challenge the Rwandan Holocaust presents to the Christian church. The killers did not merely kill people in churches. They killed church workers. They killed pastors, ministers, priests, and nuns. However, the most shocking aspect of the anti-Christian mass murders in Rwanda 24 years ago was how many people responsible for the slaughter were trusted members of congregations. On many occasions, even Catholic priests and nuns, and even Protestant ministers were directly involved in the genocide, organizing it even. Several heads of denominations cooperated with the Interahamwe by betraying their Tutsi congregations and co-workers into the hands of the mass murderers. The role of these Christian traitors, these blood-stained bishops and murderous ministers of Rwanda, are an indictment upon many theological seminaries and church councils. Those who do not wholeheartedly love the Lord Jesus and his word are not qualified to be spiritual leaders. The Rwandan Holocaust exposes the emptiness of the superficial and self-centered easy believism, which all too often masquerades as the gospel. Compromise and cowardice helped cause the catastrophe. More importantly, Holocaust in Rwanda looks at some of the lessons which need to be learned in order to ensure that such atrocities do not reoccur. Far more important than the concerns for retribution is the urge and the need to lay foundations for the future that will prevent such nationwide oppression from ever reoccurring again. These are biblical principles which are not only important for Rwanda, but for every society which values life and liberty. Holocaust in Rwanda therefore concludes with the biblical principles which, had they been adhered to, there would have been no Holocaust in Rwanda. Now, I've read an interesting book since then, Shake Hands with the Devil. These are the words of Canadian General Romeo Dallaire, the commander of the United Nations mission to UNAMIR. UNAMIR was the United Nations mission to Rwanda. So, General Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general in charge of UN peacekeeping forces in Rwanda, said in his book, Shake Hands with the Devil, which has also been made into a dramatic film, "I know there is a God, because in Rwanda, I shook hands with the devil. I've seen him, I've smelt him, and I've touched him. I know the devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God." Those are the words of General Romeo Dallaire, commander of United Nations mission to Rwanda, in his book, Shake Hands with the Devil, where he documents the unfolding catastrophe, and as he put it in the subtitle of his book, the failure of humanity in Rwanda. I would have called it the failure of the United Nations, but indeed it was a failure of humanism and therefore humanity to an extent. As the people of Rwanda soberly reflect this month on the Holocaust, which was unleashed upon them 24 years ago, April 1994, there are still compelling questions which demand answers. How could such dreadful mass murder take place within sight and sound of the United Nations peacekeepers, without the international community doing anything to stop it? Could the Holocaust in Rwanda have been prevented? Well, the answer is absolutely. What steps must we take to ensure that such atrocities do not occur again? General Romeo Dallaire reports that the United Nations leadership knew of the stockpiling of weapons. Indeed, United Nations Secretary General Boutros Ghali, in his role as the Egyptian foreign minister, had facilitated a large sale of arms from Egypt to the MRND dictatorship in Rwanda prior to the genocide. The Rwandan Armed Forces, FAR, expanded rapidly, trebling in size while receiving much training and weapons from the French government. From March 1993, more than a year before the genocide occurred, the Hutu MRND government began compiling lists of what they called traitors, who they planned to kill, meticulously marking the addresses. Now, these were mostly Tutsi, but also some Hutus who had dealings with the Tutsi. Radio Television Libre de Mille Collines, or RTLM, broadcast a mixture of tribal propaganda, music, and obscene jokes and hate speech against the Tutsi, continually inciting the Hutu majority to hate, to despise, and to want to massacre the Tutsi minority tribe. Hundreds of thousands of machetes were imported from Red China. The Interahamwe Party thugs of the MRND were armed with AK-47s and massive quantities of machetes or pangas distributed throughout the country in preparation for the genocide. General Dallaire informed the Secretary General of the United Nations of these ominous developments and of the propaganda and of the existence of these death lists. However, when he planned to seize the illegal weapon stockpiles, still in warehouses at that stage, Dallaire was stunned to be ordered by the General Secretary of the UN to stand down and to under no circumstances interfere. The general in charge of UNAMIR was strictly forbidden to intervene. The assassination of Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana by French heat-seeking missile fired by his own presidential guard on the 6th of April, 1994, was the pretext to launch the well-prepared genocide of the mostly Protestant Tutsi minority tribe. Government forces set up a dense network of roadblocks and mobilized Interahamwe mobs to systematically go house to house, massacring Tutsi. At roadblocks, those identified as Tutsi were pulled out and hacked to death on the spot. Out of the total population of 7.3 million, of which 84% were Hutu, 15% Tutsi, and 1% Twa, African rights calculated 750,000 people murdered, 750,000 murdered. The United Nations estimated the toll as above 800,000. The present government of Rwanda and the Holocaust Museum in Kigali, which I visited, states that 1,171,000 were killed, 90% of which were of the Tutsi minority tribe, most of which were Protestant Christians. The Genocide Museum in Kigali calculates that during the 100 days of the genocide, an average of 10,000 were murdered every day, 400 every hour. 7 people were murdered every minute over 100 days. They estimate that over 400,000 children were orphaned as a result of the genocide. The 2005 film Shooting Dogs, which was released in the United States as Beyond the Gates, is a British-made film focused on the United Nations abandoning the École Technique Officielle, or ETO, school in Kigali in 1994. Based on the experience of BBC News producer David Belton, who worked in Rwanda during the genocide, Belton was the film's co-writer and one of the producers. Now, unlike the Hotel Rwanda film, which was filmed in South Africa using American and South African actors, as far as I know, there was no Rwandese in the film. Hotel Rwanda, unfortunately, was a Hollywood version that really ignores the main culprits and the why, and totally centers the form of any Christian content. I mean, there you are in the middle of the genocide, and nobody is praying, nobody's singing hymns, there's nothing vaguely Christian taking place. And they also try and make it into a racist thing where somehow or another the white Europeans are to blame for what the Hutu mass murderers are doing to the Tutsi, and absolutely bizarre. And one of the most disgusting scenes in Hotel Rwanda is where the UN colonel, who, being a Canadian, was probably based loosely on General Roméo Dallaire, says to the hotel manager, who so bravely managed to hide and save many hundreds of the victims, he says, "The reason why the Europeans, the whites, don't care is because you're black, you're lower than dirt, you don't matter. Well, that's just not true, because the head of the UN at that time was an African, and the head of the UN Security Council was also African. In fact, he's from Ghana. And so to try and make absolute failure of the black-run UN into white prejudice that they didn't care about Christians isn't true. Because, in fact, the UN did a lot to save black people in Somalia, for example, but those were Muslims. What he should have been saying is, you're Christians. You're worse than dirt. That would be true, because the UN has done everything they can to help Muslims in Bosnia and Muslims in Somalia, but they don't seem to care about Christians in Rwanda or anywhere else for that matter. And the anti-Christian prejudice of the UN has been seen in Sudan, where I've done a lot of work and where local pastors have said to me, it's not that the United Nations is against religion. It's just that they're against Christianity. And that's true. That's on target. Well, beyond the gates, unlike Hotel Rwanda, which was filmed in South Africa using American and South African actors, the film Beyond the Gates was shot at the original locations in Rwanda, and the scenes it portrays in Rwanda are the actual scenes where these things took place. Most of the actors in the film were Rwandese survivors of the massacres or their children. And the film's title, Shooting Dogs, refers to the actions of the UN soldiers in shooting the stray dogs that scavenged the bodies of the dead. Since the UN force were not allowed to shoot at the Hutu mass murderers who were causing the deaths in the first place, the shooting of the dogs was symbolic of the madness of the situation and the insanity of the rules of engagement of the United Nations. General Dallaire had sent a faxed message to the United Nations headquarters in January 1994, months before the genocide, and he detailed the planned anti-Tutsi genocide. He identified the locations of the illegal arms caches. He identified the order to register all Tutsis in Kigali and the Interahamwe plans to use these lists to exterminate them all, house by house, block by block, suburb by suburb. A high-level informant provided exact details on the Interahamwe plans, including the fact that they calculated they could kill 1,000 Tutsi every 20 minutes. When the United Nations abandoned the Don Bosco Technical School, filled with over 2,000 Tutsi refugees, the Hutu Interahamwe slaughtered them all. And this is what was documented in the film Shooting Dogs or Beyond the Gates. The administrative head of UNAMIR was Cameroonian Foreign Minister, or former Cameroonian Foreign Minister, Jacques Roger Boubou. He maintained close ties with the militant Hutu elite, and on every side, this Jacques Roger Boubou, who is the UN administrative head of UNAMIR, he undermined and frustrated Canadian General Roméo Dallaire's efforts to prevent the genocide and to actually try to save lives. The United States President Bill Clinton's administration policy also undermined every effort by General Dallaire to save lives in Rwanda, and he documents that. The Clinton administration policy was summarized by General Dallaire as, let us withdraw altogether, let's get out of Rwanda, leave it to its fate. The United Nations, or the United States, ambassador to the United Nations at the time, Madeleine Albright, consistently lobbied for the withdrawal of UNAMIR forces from the earliest in April 1994. This effectively abandoned all the refugees who had fled and sought sanctuary with the United Nations to their fate at the hands of the Interahamwe. And time after time, the UN drove out, leaving the refugees who had fled to him for sanctuary to the Interahamwe, who slaughtered them all. UN, or I should say, United States Secretary of State Warren Christopher, consistently argued against using the term genocide until the 21st of May. So for a month and a half, the UN Secretary of State argued and argued against any action on the basis of that it mustn't call it a genocide because you can't use the term genocide. They admitted that acts of genocide taking place, but they denied that genocide was taking place, which is really playing games with words. So the United States Secretary of State really seriously undermined the efforts of other UN members of the Security Council, such as Czechoslovakia, who are desperately trying to intervene and to save lives and to allow the UNAMIR administration and the peacekeepers under General Roméo Dallaire to actually save lives. And even after the 21st of May, U.S. officials waited another 3 weeks before using the term genocide in public. The U.S. government also refused to jam the extremist RTLM radio broadcasts, which were coordinating the genocide. And the U.S. government under Clinton cited costs and concern with international law, while genocide was wiping out people by the thousands every single day. General Dallaire reveals that President Bill Clinton and his Democratic Party cabinet were well aware of the final solution to exterminate all Tutsi well before the massacres even began, months before. Every request from General Dallaire was frustrated, and his peacekeepers did not receive the food, the fuel, the weapons, the equipment, the ammunition, or even the armored personnel carriers that they pleaded for and ordered frequently. United Nations procrastination led to intense suffering, many unnecessary deaths, and even starvation in United Nations bases, which were meant to be sanctuaries for refugees fleeing the killing. The disgraceful role of France in the Rwandan genocide defies belief. The French government provided vast quantities of weapons and numerous military advisors and technical assistance to the Rwandan armed forces before and during the genocide. On the 22nd of June, the Tutsi-led Rwandese Patriotic Front, the RPF, turned the tide and in a David versus Goliath operation began to liberate the country, sending the Hutu forces, armed Rwandese, and the Interahamwe mass murderers fleeing. The French then launched Operation Turquoise, creating a safe zone into which the Hutu forces and Interahamwe mass murderers could flee and receive protection behind a French military screen. The French Operation Turquoise effectively enabled the genocide lunatics, the genocidaries as they called them, to escape from the Rwandese Patriotic Front and to flee into neighboring Zaire, what today is called the Congo, but then was called Zaire. And there they received generous quantities of foreign aid and caused many more massacres, leading to the Great Lakes War of 1996 to 1997, in which 12 African nations' armed forces became embroiled and millions died. Most people don't know about the Great Lakes War of the late 90s, but this was a ripple effect of Operation Turquoise, where the French military enabled the mass murderers and genocidal lunatics who had been trying to destroy the Tutsi Protestant Christians in Rwanda to escape into Zaire. General Dallaire reported that France was supplying weapons and ammunition to the MRND Hutu dictatorship and their forces, even during the height of the genocide. This is absolutely beyond comprehension that any responsible government in Europe would be aiding and abetting genocide, even after the full extent of it was becoming known in the world. General Dallaire also reports on the findings of the Rwandese Judicial Commission, which was released on 5 August 2008. The Rwandese Justice Commission released their finding on 5 August 2008, which accused 32 senior French military and political officials of involvement in the genocide. This included the then President of France, François Mitterrand, his General Secretary, Hubert Védrine, the then Prime Minister, Edouard Balladur, and then Foreign Minister Alain Juppé, and his chief aide, Dominique de Villepin. As a result of the Rwandese Justice Ministry Commission on the involvement of France in the genocide, the Rwandese government shut down all French institutions in and around Kigali, including schools and cultural organizations. The language of instruction in Rwandese schools was switched from French to English. Rwanda became one of only two members of the British-led Commonwealth that had not formerly been British colonies. I can never forget the overwhelming stench of death as I walked knee-deep and sometimes waist-high amidst corpses in churches in Rwanda, the plague of rats feasting off the bodies, the millions of flying and crawling insects, and the suffocating odor of death is not something you can ever really recover from. I delivered Bibles in Kinyi, Rwanda, and French to pastors and to prisoners around Rwanda, and I undertook painful interviews with survivors to document what had happened. and more importantly, why it had happened. We produced two editions of Holocaust in Rwanda, subtitled The Roles of Gun Control, Media Manipulation, Liberal Church Leaders, and the United Nations. We produced two editions in English, another edition in French. It needs to be emphasized that Rwanda was a gun-free zone. The mass murderers successfully manipulated and abused the media to vilify the targeted Tutsis and to dehumanize them and to mobilize masses of Hutus to kill their neighbors, whom they called Inyenzis, cockroaches. The scandalous role of the French government in providing assistance, training, and weapons and ammunition to the mass murderers and providing sanctuary for the architects of the genocide is also revealed in our book and by others. In addition, Holocaust in Rwanda looks at the challenge that the systematic mass murderers presents to the Christian church today. The killers did not merely kill people in churches, they killed church workers, pastors, ministers. However, the most shocking aspect of the anti-Christian mass murder was how many people responsible for the mass murders were trusted members of congregations, including the heads of the Anglican and Catholic churches in Rwanda. On many occasions, bishops, priests, nuns, pastors were directly involved in the genocide. Several heads of denominations, including of the Anglican and Catholic, cooperated with the Interahamwe, betraying the Tutsi members and co-workers into the hands of ruthless mass murderers. Tribalism seemed more important to most. And the role of these traitors, these blood-stained bishops and murderous ministers, are an indictment upon theological seminaries and church councils. Those who do not wholeheartedly love the Lord Jesus Christ and His word should never be qualified to be spiritual leaders. Moral cowardice helped cause the catastrophe. There are many Judases in the church. 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2 says, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you." The Rwandan Holocaust exposed the emptiness of superficial, self-centered, easy believism that all too often is masquerading as the gospel. Compromise and cowardice helped cause the catastrophe. But from the positive side, we can report that the genocide ultimately failed. David defeated Goliath. The victims became the victors. The Tutsi minority surprised everyone by fighting back and gaining control over the whole country. Today, Rwanda is one of the best-run and most open to free enterprise countries in Africa. Psalm 127 verse 1 says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." It is so important that we learn the lessons, the firm foundations for freedom, which need to be learned in order to ensure that such atrocities do not occur again. We have people in South Africa right now calling for confiscation of all white farms without compensation. We have people saying we must cut the throats of whiteness. We have incendiary political rabble-rousers like Julius Malema espousing classic Marxist revolutionary terminology and genocidal hate speech, singing, "Kill the Boer, kill the farmer, one settler, one bullet, bring me my machine gun," and all kinds of other kinds of irresponsible whipping up of hatred against whites, claiming all whites stole the land, which is absolute nonsense. In fact, there has been a reward offered for many years now for anyone to prove evidence of one white having stolen land from anyone in South Africa. And yet we have got a president, Cyril Ramaphosa, of the African National Congress, the ANC in South Africa, who right now are talking about taking the land back from white farmers without any compensation. What do you mean taking it back? Those farms were wilderness before those farmers started to carve the vineyards and the orchards out of the wilderness and turn places like Olifantshoek into Franschhoek. And they didn't steal it from anyone. They bought it. It cost them a lot. They were paying for it for sometimes more than a generation. They had to pay for every farm implement, and they, with blood, sweat, toil, and tears, harvested out of the wilderness and created great agricultural lands out of what beforehand was thornbush and dust, and many cases, just Karoo and Kalahari semi-desert, but in arid environments. We find most of the farms in South Africa are actually today in the Cape, in Northern Cape and the Western Cape, which is very arid. And yet they are being accused of being thieves, which is not true. And yet the government, in trying to dehumanize the white people and trying to demonize them and vilify them and whip up racial hatred and distract attention from the complete failure and corruption of government in our country, where the African Union estimates that 25% of the gross domestic product of Africa, in the case of South Africa, more than 1 trillion rand is stolen, lost through corruption every year to government mismanagement. And yet the government is trying to distract the many citizens that they have let down and betrayed and stolen from. And they're trying to distract them with a smokescreen by directing their hostility and the anger towards the white commercial farmers who are feeding the country. In 1994, when Nelson Mandela became president, we had 70,000 white commercial farmers who were feeding 100 million people in Africa. Today, our population has more than doubled, but the number of farmers has decreased so dramatically we have less than 30,000. It's probably more like 26,000 farmers left, commercial white farmers in South Africa today, who are feeding 40 million people. But the population has increased to 56 million now. And so we're not even able to feed all of our own people, let alone people across the border who used to depend on South African exports. And so the situation is very dire. And yet irresponsible politicians are talking about killing whites, cutting the throat of whiteness, eradicating whites, slaughtering all the whites, butchering all the whites, exterminating the whites, expunging whites, cleansing the land of all whites, very much echoing the kind of terminology used by the Rwandese genocidaries back in 1994 and the years leading up to the genocide in Rwanda. There is so much for us to learn from the tragic events of 1994 that are most relevant in the light of those talking about a second phase of the revolution in South Africa and threatening to exterminate the white minority. Well, just as in Rwanda, where a small minority, the Tutsi minority, managed to turn the tide and in a David versus Goliath campaign managed to seize control of the country and send many of the genocidal maniacs fleeing across the border, I think anyone who attempts a genocide in South Africa will be horribly surprised by how quickly that can boomerang on their heads. Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield and the one in whom I take refuge. Psalm 144 has been a prayer that was prayed by many South African Defence Force soldiers when fighting against the Soviets and Cubans in Angola during the war there in the 70s and 80s. And many are still alive today. And if forced, they would stand and they would fight. And there is no doubt that any attempt at a genocide against whites in South Africa would fail. But how many innocent people would suffer in the bloodbath before it came to an end? There's so much that we need to learn from the Holocaust in Rwanda. You can find on the Frontline Fellowship website, frontlinemissionsa.org, more articles dealing with this, and also from Christian Liberty Books, Holocaust in Rwanda is available. It's got a lot of the resources, 70 pages, 20 photographs, maps, and charts available in English and in French. Holocaust in Rwanda is also available as an ebook. You can look on christianlibertybooks.co.za or visit frontlinemissionsa.org website. Until next week, this is Peter Hammond signing off for From the Frontline. God bless and good night.